And you're tuned to KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. And I'm Jill Cloutier for Sustainable World. That was Bruce Goldish with Passion. And on today's show, I'm airing an interview with Australian keyline designer Darren Doherty. And for those listeners who tuned in last week and expecting to hear Darren speak about keyline design, you instead heard Wesley Rowe of the Santa Barbara Permaculture Network and myself attempting to talk about keyline. And you'll be relieved to know that Wes and I spoke with Darren Monday of this week. And Darren missed the show last Friday due to a misunderstanding about time zones, which I can understand since it was 2 a.m. 9 o'clock Pacific Standard Time in California is 2 a.m. in Australia. So we did interview Darren Monday, and I'll be playing that today in the show. Also, I'll be playing Sustainable Business News with Kevin Childerly and reading a local calendar of events. And if you would like to submit an event to our calendar, you can email me at sustainableworldradio@earthlink.net. And today, last night when I was doing some research for the show today, I was reading the BBC News, and they were saying on their website that today is the day when a UN report is set to announce that global warming is, quote, already changing the world, end quote, and that climate change is already having major impacts on the natural world. In this story from the BBC News, it states that the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, believes that there is also a discernible, though less marked, impact on human societies. The IPCC is set to release a summary of its report today, but talks on wording continued late into the night. An official said there were differences between various countries on the strength of the language, and that the Europeans wanted to send a strong signal, and that the U.S. does not want as much quantification. An official told the French news agency AFP, China and Russia joined with the U.S., and they also had concerns about some passages of the 21-page summary, the official said. The last-minute wrangling is likely to affect the degree of certainty in the final version, the BBC's Richard Black reported, but not the overall direction of the report. And draft versions that were seen by BBC News warned that it will be hard for societies to adapt to all of the likely climate impacts. The report is set to say that a temperature rise above 1.5 Celsius from 1990 levels would put about one-third of species at risk of extinction. More than 1 billion people would be at greater risk of water shortages, primarily because of the melting of mountain glaciers and ice fields, which act as natural reservoirs. And so the scientific work reviewed by the IPCC scientists included more than 29,000 pieces of data on observed changes in physical and biological aspects of the natural world. 85% of these, it believes, are consistent with a warming world. And so they're talking about how we're going to have water shortages and the ice is disappearing. Spring and autumn floods become more likely with increased risk of drought in summer. And the IPCC is expected to say that there is, quote, very high confidence, end quote, that these trends are already occurring. It is also projecting a higher risk of flooding for many major cities on or near the coast. And some observers of climate issues have long maintained that action on climate change should focus on protecting societies and natural systems against impacts such as floods and drought, rather than on curbing greenhouse gas emissions. The IPCC, however, is set to conclude that, quote, adaptation alone is not expected to cope with all of the projected effects of climate change, and especially not over the long run, as most impacts increase in magnitude. And so this is the second in a series of IPCC reports coming out this year, together making up its fourth global climate assessment. And the first element on the science of climate change was released in February and concluded it is at least 90% likely that human activities are principally responsible for the warming observed since 1950. So that's the bad news. And I read that story today not to scare listeners, but to illustrate some of the challenges ahead and challenges that face us. The good news is that there are solutions to some of these challenges. And I believe after interviewing Darren Doherty and doing some research on keyline design, that keyline, along with permaculture, offers many, many solutions to these challenges. In the following interview, keyline designer Darren Doherty discusses not only the basics of keyline design, but also how keyline builds topsoil and can do so in three seasons. It sequestrates carbon at a rapid rate and conserves water. Darren Doherty has had extensive experience teaching key line design and permaculture across Eastern Australia and more recently in Vietnam. Darren has been a co-teacher of permaculture design courses with Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. He is an Australian-approved key line design farm planning consultant. And for those listeners who don't know, key line is a set of principles and techniques based on a whole systems approach that works with natural patterns to restore or increase the depth and fertility of the soil while increasing its water holding capabilities. Key line integrates terraces, ponds, and cultivation techniques with the natural landscape to infiltrate water into the soil efficiently and hold it on the land as long as possible. And in order to truly work with nature, implementing a key line system requires careful observation and assessment of that site. So Darren joined us on Monday here in the studio by phone from Australia. And unfortunately, there is a slight buzzing sound on the phone line. And we called Darren a few times trying to alleviate that sound. We couldn't get rid of it, but he is in Australia, so bear with us. Hopefully the sound quality will be okay. So this is Darren Doherty from Australia in the last 45 minutes before he left for a world tour teaching key line and permaculture. You're listening to KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. I'm Jill Cloutier, and this is Sustainable World, and here is Darren Doherty. That was the business news. Let me get Darren Doherty. That's coming up in a minute. Here is Darren Doherty.
Wow, it's a lovely dark morning here in Bendigo.
Yeah, it's nice to have Darren awake and with us. We tried to do it when you were in your sleep last time. It was hard.
Yeah, no, you did very well, so I hear.
We tried to channel you, Darren, but our Australian accent sucked.
Yeah,
yeah, no, I heard that as well.
Okay, Darren, so what we're going to start with is, I guess we'll just start with the beginning. Okay, so Darren... Darren, as a child, you lived on your family farm with your grandfather,
yep,
Frank Dole, and according to your website, your grandfather passed on a range of rural skills and farming and self-reliance, and I know he had dams on the farm, and you built your first dam with your grandfather. How much of an influence did he have on your choice of work in permaculture and key line design, would you say?
I'm going to have to... are we on yet?
Yeah, you're on.
Oh, cool. I'm going to have to... perhaps dilute that a bit, because he once said to me that, Darren, if ever the manure hits the fan, then these rural skills I pass on to you will keep you above water and your family above water.
He was a wise man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, he was a bit of a classic. So, yes, he had a huge impact on me. I mean, he was basically my father, so, and my maternal father, which is interesting as well.
Very interesting. And Darren, let's just start with the basics of what is key line design, and maybe like an intro to key line design for dummies, for people who know nothing about it.
Yeah, key line design was developed in the 1940s and 50s by P.A. Yeomans, who was a mining geologist and lots of other things, as a lot of Aussies were back then. And he had developed a farm, and when he was developing it, he was using the old American Army Corps, or Corps of Engineer, soil conservation methods, which were in vogue from the sort of late 1920s through, and were pretty roundly adopted in Australia. And he found that they were fairly limited, because they worked on the basis of conservation of soil as opposed to creation of soil, which is a pretty major difference, to conserve something as opposed to actually make more of it. And so that's where he sort of started with it. And then he started to, through his observation as a mining geologist driving all over Australia and New Guinea, that the Chinese miners had used ditches on contour to collect water and then put it into dams. And then those dams were high up in the landscape. Much higher in the landscape than farm dams were at that time. And then they were used for their gravity feed potential to wash the ore, wash the dirt away from the gold ore in what's called a sluice. So based on that, he sort of put two and two together, as any multidisciplinarian would, and came out with 20 in that he put these ideas of water harvesting into practice on farm, and then started to irrigate from, as opposed to washing ore, he used the gravity to irrigate his farm. His farm was quite a, you know, quite heavily sloped, and so he was able to do something that people in anywhere weren't able to do before, which was to irrigate sloping land using gravity. And he also observed that there was a peculiar part of the landscape called a key point. A key point is found in the primary gully of a topography, of a foothills landscape. And if I could just say, I look at the landscape as being a system of ridge lines, which are like a roof on your house. So you've got the ridge line, then you've got the roof itself, and then you've got the gutters, and then you've got the downpipes, and you've got the tanks. So Yeomans looked at that, and he looked at the roof as being the primary gully, and the little ridges on the roof on the corrugated iron are like the primary ridges, and the main ridge is the ridge on top of the roof. And in those primary gullies, where the landform changes from being convex to concave, is what's called a key point. It's a very peculiar geographical feature in the landscape, and from that comes the key line.
So, Darren, does all land have a key point?
No. Well, yes and no. That's a good question. Students ask me this because when we do permaculture courses or key line courses, you know, the first thing people want to know is where is this imaginary point in the landscape? And I say, well, look, you've got them all over your body. If you look between the webs, you know, the webbing in your fingers, the landform changes from being concave at the top to being convex, and that's the key point. If you look at your chest, I say, well, look, that's another point in the landscape. You've got two ridges. Some ridges are bigger than others.
Especially in Los Angeles.
And then in the middle, you've got your sternum, and the sternum, which is basically the saddle in the landscape. That's another position in the landscape. So saddles in ridge lines and in the primary gullies that come off ridges, those first gullies that come off ridges, that's the other place where you can find them. You can still use the principles of key line in pretty well any landscape, though. You can do key line without a key point, which is a key point in itself.
This is a question, just an aside, that Kevin, my boyfriend, was explaining something to me, and he was wondering if when surfers are surfing, are they surfing the key line of the wave? Could you make that analogy?
They are. They're pointing the nick point, or the, as someone said to me in a class in New Zealand last week, some smart person who did physics, calculus rather, they said it's the point of inflection. So I said, oh yes, I'll use that one, so I'm using it the first time there. So yes, it is exactly that. Yeah. So even in aquatic landscapes, you can find a key point. Although, like I said, it's only found in a gully, so it's slightly different in terms of topography. But yeah, you could look at it that way.
Now, Darren, are key lines contour lines?
The key line is the contour line that comes off the key point. So to make that simpler, you put a when you identify your key point, you just put a peg in there, say that's at 100 feet of elevation. You then go around with your level and you mark out until the ridge, the adjacent ridges, and you mark out a contour line from that. And that's the key line of that gully. And then you go over to the next gully, and this is where it's really interesting, because as you go down a ridge, main ridge line actually reduces in height as you go down it. And each subsequent gully, actually, the key point drops in elevation. And this was where it was really revelatory for Yeomans, because he could then see that if we put a dam in the first one and collected the water from the key lines into that dam, then if that dam overflowed, then it would overflow to the next dam, which would be in the next gully to be slightly lower, and then so on and so forth. So you get this sort of stepping across the landscape. So you're really slowing the water down when you embrace this system in foothills topography.
And that's one of the benefits. I was reading online about some of the benefits of keyline design. It's amazing about the water conservation and the utilization of water resources. And that's very helpful here in California.
Yeah, well, it's not just that. In Australia, because of our laws regarding water capture, it's I think as of 3 years ago now, where there's been a cap put on the amount of dams that can be built, farm dams that can be built in the Murray-Darling Basin, which is equivalent, which is our main river system, the Murray and Darling Rivers. And they basically put a cap on farm dams, so that's really limited the amount of keyline work that we can do in terms of new farm dams. So we're using the other aspects of keyline, which is particularly in soil development, because the soil in itself is perhaps where it's well made, you know, where it's got lots of humus and lots of organic matter, etc., and good depth. It's a lake or a dam in itself and can store and capture and store a heck of a lot of rainwater. In fact, a lot more than what a dam can do per unit of area. So it's a very, and of course you can get the increased production as a result.
If someone wanted to use keyline design on their land, how would they get started with this?
Well, the first thing is to do a full assessment of your landscape. And when I say a full assessment of the landscape, the best way to do that is to do some sort of topographic survey of your property. Now, in the absence of getting a surveyor out there, well, then you'll have to use the government topographic maps, which, from what I've observed in the United States, are quite good, so like they are here in Australia. So you start off with that, and then, you know, you look at the patterns of the land, and unfortunately, most of our land has been divided by the pattern of the surveyor, the Euclidean line, the straight line. So what we have to then do is we have to work with these organic shapes in square boxes or rectangular shapes or odd shapes. And so whatever the case, we look at our whole landscape, and then we start to identify where the positions in those gullies are, that where the key points might lie. It's pretty easy to find on a contour map because it's where in a gully where you go up the gully and then the contour lines close and all of a sudden, and then they open out again. Now that point suggests that there's a change, a distinct change in the elevation of that gully, which is about where the key point is. So you will say, all right, well that's about where we will put our highest dams in the landscape, where we don't have the sort of ridgeline topography. If it's not too steep in the ridgeline, well then you might be able to put a saddle dam up there as well. And we look at how we can utilize those lands, the land's patterns, to be able to then direct by overland runoff capture water into those storages. Now, there's other parts of it as well. Like I said, you know, this is an engineering job as much as anything else. So we need to do some investigation of the soils and particularly in California, and the seismic aspects of the site. So we do this what's called geotechnical testing of where we've sort of suggested dams might go. And that involves getting an engineer to come out and drill some holes and where the dam is going to be and or proposed to be. And then we test the material to see how permeable it is. Actually, will it hold water? And then they can also make some assessments as to the risks, because, you know, when you're putting water high up in the landscape, anywhere in the landscape, in large volumes, then there's inherent risks that you need to apply due diligence to. And part of that is the investigation process and the planning process. So then you can make your decisions about how you will react to the situations that you find.
Darren, what would a successful keyline design property look like? How would that be different from maybe adjoining properties that did not use this system?
Well, in Australia at the moment, it'd look green. that's a big start. I think California, with your very similar Mediterranean climate to the southern part of Australia where I live, is quite similar. So yes, lots of green grass throughout the summer, dry summer months, because you've captured all of that water over the winter months, and now you're able to release it over your landscape to get more pasture growth. You're also going to see trees on contour incorporated as part of the overall design, and they will be like, if you've got a pastoral property, they will be in steps down the landscape, down the slope. So you've got like what we call contour strip forests, and they obviously create a huge change in the landscape. You will also see some sort of pattern that respects the sort of natural patterns of the landscape as well, which is, like I said before, a bit different to how most properties are organised. What probably you will see the greatest difference in, apart from the green grass, would be that there's a all of the lines are actually of trees and pastures are equidistant. That means that you can basically, unlike contour ploughing, where a lot of people would be familiar with the soil conservation ploughing and the check banks that are put in there, that because you're following contours, well, contours aren't actually parallel to each other as you go down the slope. So you actually, if you use contour ploughing, you actually miss out, or contour check banks, you miss out on a lot of land that you could actually be utilising, because the contours are not running parallel to each other. Now, when you use machinery to do any ploughing or cutting grass or cutting hay or whatever else, then if you don't have two lines parallel to each other, you're going to run out of room really fast. And I think that that would be perhaps one of the most unusual aspects compared to the normal landscapes out there.
Darren, one of the key things that part of the key line design is the use of the key line plow. And
yep.
Could you describe, you know, how that is integrated into the design?
Yeah, we've been really lucky that Yeoman's Plow Company are sending us a fully specced key line plow out, which is going to be fantastic. It's better than the ones that I've got at home, so I'm really looking forward to that. It'll be on the port really soon. But the key line plow was developed in the late 60s. And before that, Yeoman's was influenced by the likes of Louis Bronfield and others who were using chisel plows, which operate similarly but with greater amount of disturbance, and in terms of soil disturbance when you pull it through the ground. And he was using and marketing in Australia a plough called the Graham Home Chisel Plough, which was, I think, from Amarillo in Texas, from memory. And that was really good. The pattern of the ploughing is the most critical thing, though. And this is where you can use the principles of key line pretty well anywhere, where you actually, if you are going around the slopes sort of on a contour, well, then if you slightly fall out of a gully towards the ridge, and then you go around the ridge sort of on contour, and then plough slightly uphill into the gully, and then slightly downhill. So you've got this sort of, not quite a herringbone, but this is just this subtle off-contour ploughing. Now what that does, as well as the effects of getting air, water and light into the soil, what it does is it diverts the water out of the gullies out onto the ridges. And that's an extremely pervasive means of increasing production on a property, because nature always has waterfall at 90 degrees to a contour. Now you've got these little grooves in the ground that the key line plough has made, or a plough that's similar has made. Just by that subtle pattern change, you've now directed water out to the ridges, which is where it's always falling from. And ridges always have better aspect to the sun. They also have much better air drainage. The air is always falling away from them, so they don't tend to be as frosty. They don't. Their downside is that they don't seem to have as deep as soils, so they don't have as great a water holding capacity. But that can be very quickly changed by the action of the plough and adding water to the action of the plough, and then you can get the very, very, very fast soil development across your property, not just in isolated areas. And that's extremely pervasive because, you know, if you look at a property, especially if you look at aerial photos, you'll see the aerial photos taken at the dry season, and you'll see the ridges are always very dry, and then you'll see the gullies have got a bit of a green tinge because of the moisture that's actually reserved there. On key lime properties, that green tinge extends out onto the ridges. Now, the other aspect of key lime ploughing, which is extremely important, is that it actually requires grazing production or hay cutting or something like that to actually build the soil. That's a really, really critical part of it. So it fits in really well with sort of modern cell grazing or phase grazing, pulse grazing techniques, in that you do your ploughing and that you go through and break your hard pan. And then this plough, like I said, it doesn't turn the soil over. It leaves the sod intact. It just puts about a half an inch wide groove in the soil. It does all of its work underground. Then then what you do is you come through with your, once the grass has sort of just grown up to before flowering, at that stage the root system of the grasses is at its maximum and maximum density. And because the plant is going out and mining all of the nutrients in the soil ready for that very intense period of reproduction in flowering and in seeding. And as Yeoman said, what you've got to do then is stem the reproductive urges of the plant, as it were. And so get in there and graze all of that off. Now, that when you graze, well, that turns into meat. Or if you cut hay, well, then it becomes hay, which is also turned, you know, all grass, what is it, all grass is flesh, all flesh is grass. And what that does is it causes all of the roots of those grasses and herbs and legumes to all drop off, basically. If it's an annual plant, well, then the plant will die. If it's a perennial, well, then you'll get a big root loss, and it'll just go back to survival mode. Now, that's where the soil building comes from. All of those roots are now, converted by the soil microorganisms into soil, into humus. So this is where we can reverse the idea that it takes, 1,000 years to build half an inch of topsoil. Well, in key lime design, if you do this over three seasons, so you do it over autumn, spring, autumn, then you can build, up to 18 inches of soil in basically 6 to 12 months, which is pretty phenomenal. And that was really where Yeoman's hit his fame, was from his soil creation work.
Darren, this really goes against modern agriculture, where it's farming it only benefits the farmer and not benefiting the land and soil.
Yeah, it's funny that every time I talk to farmers and they try this, and people buy Yeoman's ploughs, and we've got lots of Yeoman plough copies in Australia, which is probably the greatest symbol of success here in Australia. When you use these things, and the technique works. It uses the plants that you've got. It uses the elements that we have, which are air, water, and light, and a little bit of diesel, and a bit of thyme, and just some clever grazing. So it fits in with the modern grazing as well. I mean, everyone's into cell grazing now, where they put their livestock onto a piece of land for a short time, eat the grass down, and then move them on, and then move them on, and then move them on, and then it'll be quite a long time before they actually come back to that area again. So it fits in perfectly with that sort of modern regime of stock rotation, and gives you the benefit of soil. I mean,
That's a huge benefit.
They used to say that we're not making any more of it. Well, that's obviously, not the case. The only difference between subsoil or inert soil and topsoil is life, and that's it. And you only need to put life, just feed it, and it will grow.
I would just like to say that Darren will be here in California from April 21st to May 4th. He'll be doing a series of workshops and lectures. The first lecture will be on April 21st, Saturday at 10 a.m. at the Vista Del Mar School down in Gaviota. You can kind of get to it from off of Highway 101, just cutting off into one to Lompoc, and it's just there on your left-hand side to school. And we hope to have the plow there on display. And yep. Also, we're doing another lecture on May 3rd, Thursday, and that will be from 7 to 9 with Darren at Cal Poly University, San Luis Obispo. And you can go to our website, sbpermaculture.org, and then hit upcoming events. And also, Darren will be doing three workshops, one on April 22nd to the 27th. That'll be the six-day intensive key line workshop near Goleta on the Gaviota coast. And then there'll be a following two-day workshop, and that'll be like a more intensive introduction rather than a full-on course. And that will be happening at New Kiama, back in the backcountry of Santa Barbara. And then on May 4th, up in San Luis Obispo, on the Friday, there will be just a one-day introduction. So we're offering people a whole variety of different ways to be introduced into Keyline design. And I hope you all can spread the word and tell people to come to these various lectures and workshops. And we still have openings for them. One of the things I wanted Darren to kind of approach is and talk to us about is the resources that people can go to, that books and stuff that describe Keyline, and also mention his website and maybe a little bit of his upcoming programs he's planning to do in the United States too, plus ours.
Thanks, Wes. Probably the best websites to go to. For more information to start with, one would be keylinedesigns.com.au, and that's the website of Ken Yeomans, who's the youngest son of P.A. Yeomans. That's got a heck of a lot of good stuff in it, lots of photos and diagrams and information. He also sells a book called Keyline Design, Water for Every Farm, Keyline Design. And you can buy that as an e-book through that site or as in hard copy. And I think it's available through Amazon or whomever in the United States as well. All of the old Yeomans books by P.A. Yeomans are available online at a website called soilandhealth.org.au. And it's got a lot of great books, a lot of great titles, including the out-of-print Yeomans books. So you can have a look at those there. The Yeomans Plough Company, which is yeomansplough.com.au, it has got the latest book on Keyline on it. It's called Priority One, How Together We Can Defeat Global Warming. And that's, as we didn't mention before, that's one of the most amazing things about Keyline, which has sort of emerged with our global warming and carbon sequestration issue, is that when we build soil, we're capturing atmospheric carbon at an extraordinary rate, and it's the cheapest and quickest way of being able to reverse global warming is just simply building soil. The soil carries many, many, many hundreds of tons of carbon potentially that is basically directly drawn out of the atmosphere, as opposed to with tree growing and that sort of thing where you've got quite a big lag time and perhaps lag time that we don't have. So using these methods are actually quite pervasive as a greenhouse gas sequestering method. Now, sorry to digress, but my website is permaculture.biz, it's B-I-Z, and I've got some information there on Keyline, and we're just revamping that website at the moment, so it's got lots of photos and that you can look at, and also sort of detailed information about the upcoming courses that we'll be doing across the United States, or actually across the world, as we're about to do a world tour starting in about half an hour, and when we catch the train to the airport. And I've got a lot of stuff there that was put together by Nancy over in Arizona at Timper Arts. She did a great job putting our website together. And also, if you just look around, do Google searches on Keyline Design, and you'll see that there's a heck of a lot of information and photos on Keyline on the internet, with various properties and various land managers using the principles in a whole range of different ways.
There's a great book, a great website here, Carbon Farmers out of Vermont.
Yeah, the Carbon Farmers of America. They've really embraced Yeoman's philosophy of and practice of using keyline techniques.
Describe to us what the 6-day intensive would involve.
Six-day basically is targeted at professional land managers, so farmers, ranchers, etc., but also consultants like myself, engineers, earth movers as well. So the whole range of people who may well be involved in utilising or recommending designing keyline systems in their entirety. We'll basically go through the whole gamut, and at the end of the course, people will be reasonably competent at being able to do keyline design. So we'll cover all of the aspects of what is keyline, how do you identify all of these systems, how do you actually apply keyline to a site, how do you use all of the different surveying instruments to do the work, what sort of machinery is involved, how you use that and apply that machinery, that earth-moving machinery, to do the different jobs. Also, how do you actually budget the jobs and all of that sort of thing, because that's an important part of a lot of courses that is often missed out on, particularly these type land management courses where you've actually got to spend money to do this sort of work. So how much is involved, and just being able to cost the whole project out and how to manage the whole project is and the sequence of events that happen in a project is another important aspect of that one. Whereas with the other ones, the 1 and 2 day course, we're still talking about a lot of that stuff, but we're not going into the very, very fine detail that we're doing in the 6-day intensive. But we're going to do these again, and we're trying to recommend to get people who are experienced with keyline in California and in the United States and elsewhere, so that they can they don't need an Aussie to keep coming over and using lots of carbon to save carbon.
Now, Darren, you're also going to be co-teaching a permaculture design course in Nukuyama coming up in May.
Yeah, we've got a couple of PDCs coming up. We've got Nukuyama, and which I'm sharing with very experienced, probably the world's most experienced permaculture consultant at the moment, and in Jeff Lawton, and he's an amazing guy. He's working all over Australia, all over the world. He's in the Middle East at the moment, greening the desert, and. Yeah, we'll be doing that, which I'm really looking forward to getting up and meeting Warren and the crew up at Quail Springs. And we've also got another course in the Eel River District in Northern California at a place called None of the Above Ranch, which is a 650-acre ranch. And one of my students from a course I taught in Patagonia, Erin Earle, she's organising that one. It's a debut course in terms of organising, so we're really looking forward to that one. It's in a lovely venue. We've got a couple of really good courses coming up in California that we're looking forward to getting to.
Thank you so much, Darren. And is there anything else you would like to add to tell our listeners about Keyline? Talking to you right now reminds me of when I took my permaculture design course last year. my head is just filled with these amazing ideas of how we can turn things around, and we there are positive solutions to the mess that we're in.
Well, I suppose my message is with this, and one of the reasons why I push Keyline is that I suppose it goes back to the start. You know, I a lot of people in permaculture work in sort of small landscapes, and that's all fine. We've got to do work in the cities to overcome some of the deficiencies of cities. But I always determined that I was going to work in rural landscapes because I'm from a farm. I'm a farmer's son, farmer's grandson, etc. And farming and agriculture use an enormous amount of surface area of this earth. I think it's we've got 8.5% of the lands of the earth's surface is under arable agriculture. That's plough-based agriculture. So we can we've got a huge part of the earth that's actually under control of agriculture. So it would seem to me that with a lot of the practices that we that are used out there, that we can do some improvement. And we can help some of our situation with the global warming and all of that. And at the same time, we can sort of have our cake and eat it too, because if we build up the soil, well then that's the primary resource. If we can build up our soils, well then that's good for our plants, it's good for our animals, and it's good for us and good for our pockets. So I suppose that's what I'd like to say, and that we can do it. We can do it on a budget. We don't need to spend a lot of money to apply these principles, which is very important these days with the declining terms of trade in agriculture.
It's like a win-win-win-win situation.
Yeah. Well, we need a few of those at times, don't we?
We do. And I just had a quick question for you. I read on your website about how you made so much soap that your family still has milk cartons left of the soap that you made as a kid.
Yes, Granddad never wasted a thing.
Do you still have the soap left?
Oh, yeah, but I think I'll be passing it on to my grandchildren. Well, I hope so. It's got a very unique smell.
So we'll look forward to meeting you and smelling you.
Fat and caustic soda mixed together, or lye mixed together. Yeah, it's an interesting one.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Have a great flight.
Right. Thank you, and take care.
Thank you.
Thank you, bye.
And that was Darren Doherty of Australia, Keyline Designer, and he's going to be in the Santa Barbara area. And Darren will be here April 21st, Saturday, from 10 to 12 for Keyline Design Lecture at the Vista Del Mar School District, and that's in Gaviota. Then Darren will be giving a 6-day intensive Keyline workshop near Goleta on the Gaviota coast. And that will be, April 22nd to the 27th. And then he's going to be here May 1st and 2nd at Quail Springs doing a 2-day workshop, and then again a lecture on May 3rd, Thursday, from 7 to 9, and that's going to be at Cal Poly University in the San Luis Obispo Building, Building 8, Room 123. If you would like information on Darren, you can, and Darren's schedule here in the Santa Barbara area, you can email Margie, M-A-R-G-I-E, at sbpermaculture.org, or call 805-962-2571, or go to www.sbpermaculture.org. And you're listening to Sustainable World on KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. I'm Jill Cloutier. And Darren, I wanted to ask that last question to Darren about on his website, and Darren's website, I should mention too, is www.permaculture.biz, B-I-Z. And Darren has a little section on his website talking about how when he was a kid, his grandfather didn't waste a thing and made so much soap that all of his family members have milk cartons stashed away, hundreds and hundreds of containers. And he said that one of his fondest memories as a small child was the smell of his Nana Betty Dole's arms when she cuddled him as a young fellow in front of the fire with their smell of this omnipresent fat-laden soap. So that cracked me up. But what's up next? I'm going to play Sustainable Business News with Kevin Childerly, and I'll be back with a calendar of events. Stay tuned. Here's Kevin Childerly with Sustainable Business News.
This is the business news for Sustainable World Radio, and I am your host, Kevin Childerly. Ever heard of Reed's Ginger Brew? This great little soda has now gone public. Chris Reed, owner of the company, started basically on a shoestring budget with dreams of owning his own business. Reed has taken off financially to the tune of $10 million in 2006 and forecasts 20% to 40% product growth in the coming year. Along with an impressive product line and more on the way, Chris is starting to use more organic sweeteners in his beverages, much to the interest of the medical profession and health-conscious people. If you're interested in checking out Reed's Ginger Brew online, go to reedsgingerbrew.com. The stock symbol is Reed, R-E-E-D. Washington. The Supreme Court ordered the Environmental Protection Agency on Monday to explain why it has refused to regulate greenhouse gas pollution for cars, putting the Bush administration under pressure from an unusual coalition of environmental groups and leaders of the auto industry to move quickly on global warming. In a 5-4 decision, the court rejected the administration's argument that it had no legal authority to limit carbon dioxide release from new cars. In a ruling described as a landmark victory for environmental activists, it decided that the EPA does have such authority and that it must give better reasons for not using it than the laundry list of impermissible considerations it has offered till now. The Bush administration has argued all along that Congress never gave it the power to decide whether carbon dioxide was a pollutant as defined in the Federal Clean Air Act. But, in an opinion written by Justice John Paul Stevens, the court said it did have such authority. More important, Stevens sided in an unusually strong language with scientists who say that U.S. car emissions do contribute to greenhouse gases, leading to global warming. In doing so, he rebutted the contention of some energy industrial officials and Republicans in the administration and Congress that there is no proof of global warming. This is a segment on global warming. A group of scientists is fighting a rearguard action to challenge mainstream evidence that humans are to blame for climate change. They point to natural shifts in the sun's heat, a cooling of the planet in the mid-20th century, and an apparent slowdown of temperature rises in the past decade. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, said in February that it was very likely, more than 90%, that human activities, namely fossil fuel burning, explain most of an unequivocal warming in the past 50 years. The panel said temperatures will likely rise between 1.8 and 4.2 Celsius, 3.2 and 7.8 Fahrenheit this century. The IPCC, made up of about 2,500 scientists, is endorsed by governments. There is always a bit of room for doubt. It's in the nature of science, said Rajendra Pajuri, head of the UN Climate Panel. But I cannot think of any tangible reasons for doubt. The skeptics who doubt some IPCC claims include meteorology professor Richard Lindzen of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Professor Paul Ritter from the Medical Entomology Department at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, and author Michael Crichton. Many scientists also say U.S. President George W. Bush has exaggerated the uncertainties about scientific findings to appease powerful business and oil lobbies. However, all is not lost. Check out Native Energy Online. It's under nativeenergy.com. And Native Energy is a privately held Native American energy company. And in August 2005, the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy, COOP, acquired a majority ownership interest in Native Energy on behalf of its tribal members, marking another significant step in the Great Plains Tribe's historic effort to power America with Native wind. Native Energy helps you help build Native American farmer-owned community-based renewable energy projects that create social and economic and environmental benefits. Native Americans and farmers traditionally care for and care about the environment because they are also very dependent on the gifts of the earth for their survival. They are seeking a way to build their economies and their communities. This is one of the reasons we developed our novel approach to renewable energies. We want our business and our work and our customers' purchases to make a real difference. And to summarize, as alternative sources of energy become less alternative and more mainstream, there will be a transition period. We are entering it right now. People who live in areas where wind-generated electricity is available can receive this form of energy. Solar power also is not just a few panels on your rooftop. There are places being built that will have acres of solar panels. Also, this is not just the US. China and Europe are moving into this energy rapidly. Lastly, check out online sbpermaculture.org. That features a lot of folks locally and globally making a difference. I have been your host, Kevin Chudley, for a Sustainable World Business News. And over to Jill in the studio.
And that was Kevin with the business news. And now it's time for the calendar of events, and we have a lot of things happening in Santa Barbara in the next few weeks. Darren Doherty, the man that you just heard if you were tuned in earlier in the interview from Australia, Darren will be joining Jeff Lawton as one of the teachers for the Quail Springs Permaculture Design course in May of this year. And Darren will be teaching the first week and Jeff the second week. And this is a permaculture certificate design course. And it will be happening at Quail Springs in Upper Coyama Valley on May 14th through the 27th. For information, go to www.quailsprings.org. There's going to be a food shed gathering in Santa Barbara. And at these gatherings, people get together and share food, plants, seeds, and anything else. It's a time for planting and sharing and celebrating life's gifts that are abundant and all around us. This is happening on Sunday, April 8th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 661 Catania Way, C-A-T-A-N-I-A. And for information on where that is, you can email Jacob Rodrigue, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Jacob. And here's his email, skate2x4@hotmail.com. So S-K-A-T-E. The number 2 and then an X and a 4 at hotmail.com for information on food shed gatherings. And Quail Springs, which is a permaculture farm in New Coyama, has over 400 trees to plant this weekend during this weekend of April 7th and 8th, Saturday and Sunday. They're also offering ongoing service learning projects, which include garden preparation, watershed restoration, gabion building, tree planting, and more. And 400 trees is a lot to do this weekend. All ages are welcome to volunteer, and experience is not necessary. The food is potluck, and camping is nearby. And for information, email info@quailsprings.org. Or if you want to talk to someone to receive directions and the current gate codes, call 805-886-7239. And Larry Santoyo is giving a permaculture design certificate course in San Luis Obispo. The classes are held one weekend a month for 6 months. And for information on that, call Larry at 805-459-0452. And Arlington West needs volunteers every Sunday to put up and take down the crosses at Arlington West. This is at Stearns Wharf. And the new times which started in March, are 7:30 a.m. setup and 4 p.m. takedown. So for information, email joy at grobl@cox.net if you can help, or you can just show up at Stearns Wharf and help them with the crosses there. And on Monday, April 16th, world-renowned environmental leader and theorist Dr. Michael McGonigal, co-founder of Greenpeace International, will be speaking on green alchemy, how campuses can transform their communities to meet the challenge of global warming, at 7:30 to 9:30 at the Fleischman Auditorium, Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History. And in this talk, Michael will explore the many ways institutions of higher learning can provide the vision and skills to motivate citizens to green their communities. Then on Tuesday, April 17th at 9 to noon at the Santa Barbara Public Library, Michael will be speaking on developing the local green economy. And Michael believes that local institutions of higher education have enormous resources to assist individuals seeking to enter the emerging green economy, and also that job seekers need to know what knowledge and skills are required in order to participate in the next stage of economic growth, which he believes will be developing a green economy. He will lead a discussion on the most effective means to match the aspirations and skills of those who wish to find careers in helping their communities withstand global warming with the ideas and training colleges and universities might provide. And for information on those events with Michael McGonigal, you can go to sbcc.edu/environment, and that's Santa Barbara City College Adult Education. It's part of their Living Smart, Living Sustainably series. And on Saturday, May 12th from 9 to 2, there will be a workshop on earth-friendly cuisine, The Farmer, Chef, and You. This is going to be held at Santa Barbara City College Campus Center. And at this event, you can discover more about foods that are healthy and tasty, as well as friendly to the environment and our local economy. Learn the facts about why we all need to be eating locally grown food. The workshop will feature a panel of farmers sharing stories about why they farm and how you can support them. For information on this, it's the same website as the previous event. It's sbcc.edu/environment. And if you have any events that you would like me to announce on the air, please email me at sustainableworldradio@earthlink.net. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jill Cloutier for Sustainable World. And I am going to end the show. Let's see here. I'm going to end the show with a song called Keep Your Hand on the Key Line Plow. It's really Keep Your Hand on the Plow. I added the key line, but here it is. And stay tuned. We'll be back next week. Have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.
Hold on. Hold on. Keep your hand on the plow, hold on. Hold on, oh yes. Hold on, oh yes. Keep your hand on the plow, hold on. Mary had three lengths of chain, and every length was in Jesus' name. Keep your hand on the plow, hold on.